You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we're in a pandemic, and our guest says we're also in an infodemic with too much bad information and room for misinterpretation. We'll talk to a public health educator about how to make sense of it all. Now, the time for debating is over for President Trump and former Vice President Joe Biden. The two had their second and final debate last night at Belmont University in Nashville. In a more civil affair than their last encounter, Trump and Biden talked about the coronavirus, healthcare, immigration, potential foreign conflicts of interest, climate change, and other issues. And with voting in progress, Election Day now just 11 days away, we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. What did you think of last night's debate? Were there moments that stuck out to you the most? What were you hoping to hear Trump or Biden talk about? What issue matters most to you? Do you have thoughts on the setup for the debate, the moderator, the muting of candidates' mics? Is your mind made up on who to vote for? Or are you still on the fence? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas at WPR.org. Tim Hagel is an associate professor of political science at the University of Iowa. Tim, welcome to Central Time.
Good to be with you.
Well, before we get into some of the content of the debate, do you think that voters were better served this time around than the last one in terms of learning about what the candidates might do as president next time around?
Well, the short answer is yes. With the first time around, of course, it kind of devolved into a shouting match between the two candidates, and so we didn't really learn much in the way of substance. And this time, because of a combination of the threat of muting their microphones, and I think the candidates just did a better job of adhering to the rules, that we were able to dig into things a little bit more. And it was nice enough for them to have their 2 minutes of uninterrupted time where they could kind of go through their talking points. But then there were some lively exchanges, nevertheless, where you could dig in a little bit more and get them off those talking points.
At this point in the election, do you see a debate like this, or I guess any debate, sort of, I guess, a total disaster for one of the candidates or another, moving the needle much?
Well, most people will say no, given especially this time around, because so many more people have voted early than is usually the case at this point, that there aren't that many undecideds, and a lot of the people have already decided they're just, if they watch, that they're basically just rooting for their candidate, and so it's not going to change their mind anymore. And like you say, a lot of times the only real thing that you get out of a debate is whether there's some big faux pas that some candidate makes that all of a sudden sways some voters. But like I said, I think this time that you dig into the substance a little bit more, and so I don't know, at least I found it a little bit more interesting than usual.
One thing that Republicans are highlighting about former Vice President Biden is his comments on energy and oil. And it's something that might not sway a lot of voters, but it might sway enough voters in tight states. What did you think of that part of the debate and the impact it could have?
Yeah, that's certainly something that Republicans emphasized at the time it happened. And no surprise there that, you know, the candidates' staffs are right there on Twitter and elsewhere kind of going along with whatever's being said. And when Biden basically suggested that he wanted to phase out the oil industry and also said that he hadn't said he was against fracking, that boy, you know, Twitter lit up with links to situations one way or another. And like you say, in some states like Pennsylvania, which Biden emphasizes where he's from on a fair amount, or, you know, West Virginia or some other states, Ohio even, that you have the combination of energy just in general, fracking in particular, that those are important for people for a lot of jobs. And that's something that we'll see if it makes that much of a difference, but it's certainly something that Republicans are emphasizing to try to sway those potentially undecided voters.
We're talking about last night's presidential debate. Tim Hagel with us from the University of Iowa. You can join in with your reactions at 800-642-1234. I want to give a listen to an extended bit, including both candidates here, talking about the COVID-19 pandemic, the possibility of more lockdowns. We'll hear what President Trump had to say, followed by former Vice President Biden's response. Here's a listen.
We have to open our country. We're not going to have a country. You can't do this. We can't keep this country closed. This is a massive country with a massive economy. People are losing their jobs. They're committing suicide. There's depression, alcohol, drugs at a level that nobody's ever seen before. There's abuse, tremendous abuse. We have to open our country. You know, I've said it often. The cure cannot be worse than the problem itself. And that's what's happening. And he wants to close down. He'll close down the country if one person in our massive bureaucracy says we should close it down.
Vice President Biden, your
response. Simply not true. We ought to be able to walk and chew gum at the same time. We ought to be able to safely open, but would they need resources to open? You need to be able to, for example, if you're going to open a business, have social distancing within the business. You need to have, if you have a restaurant, you need to have plexiglass dividers so people cannot infect one another. You need to be in a position where you can take testing rapidly and know whether a person is, in fact, infected. You need to be able to trace. You need to be able to provide all the resources that are needed to do this. And that is not inconsistent with saying that what we're going to make sure that we open safely.
So we have that back and forth there on COVID-19, a big issue in the country this year. What do you think about what the candidates had to say about their handling or potential handling of this disease crisis?
As far as Biden's comments in terms of saying that, well, he is in favor of opening it, and that's kind of a little bit new information. It may be on his website or something like that, but I hadn't really seen him talk about that until last night. In that before he had been sort of suggesting that we need to, you know, keep things closed to a certain extent. But what he's proposing, of course, costs a lot of money. And he, I think, had indicated at some point during the debate that it's the federal government that has the resources to do that. But, you know, at the same token, we're already in pretty heavy debt. I don't think it's something that Trump had mentioned last night, but that's basically a concern for a lot of people, although generally more Republicans than Democrats. So it was an interesting exchange, although one of the problems with the whole deal with information with the pandemic is that you get sort of inconsistent messages from various people. And it's one thing to say that, well, we're going to trust the expert or trust the scientist, but they can't all agree because we're still sorting this out to a certain extent.
Let's go to our callers now. We've got Greg on the line in Sheboygan. Greg, hi.
Okay. Hello. I was thinking about this the thing about CO2. Now, Trump passed laws so that they could take the ceiling off CO2 emissions. Well, CO2 is a unique molecule. It's got such a strong bond energy that there's no force on the Earth aside from coal formation that breaks it. People think trees do, but they don't. They break the water and they release the oxygen from water. So in essence, we dry out to make oxygen. But we could make alternate energy so easy. Biden just touched on solar and wind, but there's also wave. Give $1 million to somebody who can make wave generators so we could make big reefs of wave generators. We could
gotcha.
Make a
Greg, I think we take your point. Greg, interested in the climate change portion and the alternative energy and fossil fuels portion of the debate. Can you talk a little more about what we heard there, Tim?
Yeah, that certainly there's a big difference between Trump's approach and Biden's approach. And it's more generally, Republicans basically are saying, well, yeah, we'll go ahead and try these other things, but we can't just shut down the others too quickly because that'll hurt the economy. Whereas the Democrats usually want to speed things up a little bit. They're concerned that aside from the climate change aspects to it, that just basically you want to make that shift. One interesting thing that didn't get mentioned last night is sometimes people will say, well, look, if you really want to get away from fossil fuels, why not go nuclear? Well, of course, a lot of people don't want nuclear power for a variety of reasons, but that would certainly alleviate the problem of using fossil fuels and do so in a way that would be a lot faster than trying to develop whatever it happens to be. And certainly the government's already paid a lot of money for things like solar. And of course, here in Iowa, we're heavily invested in wind energy production. But right now, we're still not at the point where that can effectively and efficiently replace fossil fuel. So we've got a ways to go.
Thanks for the call. We are picking apart last night's second and final debate between President Trump and former Vice President Joe Biden. Tim Hagel is our guest, Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of Iowa. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What were your takeaways from last night? What stood out to you? Was there something that answered a question you had about one candidate or the other? Call 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation on last night's debate between President Trump and former Vice President Biden. We're talking to Tim Hagel, Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of Iowa. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. What stood out to you? What do you still want to know, if anything, about the candidates? Let's go back to our callers. Mac is on the line in Colfax. Mac, hi. Your line's cutting out, Mac. Mac had wanted to bring up health care, but I'm afraid we can't hear Mac too well. But hey, let's listen to some of the candidates talking about health care a little bit. The candidates were asked what they would do if the U.S. Supreme Court winds up striking down the Affordable Care Act. First of all, here's President Trump talking about that.
What I would like to do is a much better health care, much better, will always protect people with pre-existing. So I'd like to terminate Obamacare, come up with a brand new, beautiful health care. The Democrats will do it because there'll be tremendous pressure on them, and we might even have the House by that time. And I think we're going to win the House, okay? You'll see, but I think we're going to win the House. But come up with a better health care, always protecting people with pre-existing conditions.
We'll dig into that a little bit. Tim, some Democratic groups or anti-Trump groups have run ads showing the president saying he was about to release a health care plan again and again over the last few years. The criticism that he says they've got a replacement or in the works, but it never quite happens. Is that, what do you think of that line of attack?
Well, it's certainly true what you're saying, that Trump has promised it for a long time, and there's Democrats are still criticizing him for not having a plan. And the other thing, even though Trump was saying several times in that clip and it's elsewhere that the Republicans will want to keep or protect pre-existing conditions and make that a protection, not lose that, but that's something that Democrats have been hammering Republicans on pretty hard. And one of the places we saw that was in the recent Senate confirmation hearings for Judge Amy Coney Barrett, where most of the Democratic senators brought that up and showed pictures during the hearings of people who had pre-existing conditions and talked about how their lives would change. But Republicans, by and large, have said they want to protect those pre-existing conditions, but it's hard to make that case, I suppose, if you don't have a plan in place or something that people can actually talk about.
And then here's a listen to former Vice President Biden talking about the health care issue.
What I'm going to do is pass Obamacare with a public option, become Biden care. The public option is an option that says that if you, in fact, do not have the wherewithal to be, if you qualify for Medicaid and you do not have the wherewithal in your state to get Medicaid, you automatically are enrolled, providing competition for insurance companies. That's what's going to happen. Secondly, we're going to make sure we reduce the premiums and reduce drug prices by making sure that there's competition that doesn't exist now by allowing the Medicare to negotiate drug prices with the insurance companies.
Now, Tim, correct me if I'm wrong. I dimly remember a public option being in the very earliest efforts at the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare, and it lasted like 10 seconds before it got jettisoned. Why was that something that was scrapped then, but the Democratic presidential candidate says it's a pretty good idea now?
You know, I don't remember the details of that as to how that plan developed, but my best guess is that it was a matter of negotiating, that they were, and not even so much with Republicans, none of whom actually voted for it, but even among Democrats in maybe some vulnerable districts, that there were some negotiation that had to go on, that maybe this was going to cost too much, or it was going to seem too much like socialized medicine, or, you know, whatever it happens to be. And so they had to cut certain things out to make it more palatable for some of the Democrats. And so it looks like Biden wants to, you know, move in that direction again, or at least try to get it. And if they have a bigger House majority, maybe they can do it and still lose a few people who might be a little skittish about it, or in vulnerable districts or something of that nature. But it provides an easy line of attack for Republicans, too, because if Obamacare was that great, why does he need to fix it? And so that's kind of a way that they can attack him on that kind of a plan. Although, you know, with 11 days left, I'm not sure how much they can do in that regard.
Let's go back to our callers at 800-642-1234. Deneen is with us in Madison. Deneen, hi.
Hi there. Thank you.
What did you want to bring up?
I did want to talk a bit about the moment where they brought up, or Kristen Welker brought up the fact of immigration. and how, as of like 2 days ago, I believe, they came out with the number of 545 children still not having been brought back together with their parents. After 2 to 3 years, they still don't know who these kids, who their parents are and where they are. And when the moderator brought that up to Trump, he immediately went to, well, these kids came over with coyotes. It was obviously not the question. These kids came back. They came with parents. They were separated from their parents. And in the last week or two, actually in the last month, some of the reporting that has come out, that Jeff Sessions, Kirstjen Nielsen, people that were in charge of the programs that were in charge of these children at the time, they were saying they wanted to separate. This was the policy. Keep them separated. Take them away from their parents. We don't care.
Thanks a lot for calling in. So, yeah, this issue of immigration and family separation in last night's debate, Tim.
Yeah, and certainly when you're talking about children that are separated from their parents, that really tugs at your heartstrings and makes a good point for the Democrats. Although, first thing you need to ask is, well, what are the ages of these kids? And so if you're talking 16, 17, yes, they're children, but, they're getting a little closer to adult age, as opposed to if you're talking, something under 10, where that's really important and really the kind of thing that people say, oh, this is terrible. I can't verify this because I didn't see the original report, but I saw something indicating that about 80% of that number, 500 plus, were they had apparently actually contacted parents, but the parents didn't want the children to come back to whatever their home country was, that they really wanted their kids to stay in America, hopefully permanently, so that they would have more opportunities. You can sort of see that for parents where, trying to give your kid a better life, get them out of whatever environment that may be not that great in their home country. But on the other hand, from our perspective, when you're separating now, regardless of whether it was done purposefully or intentionally or whatever, but the fact that they're now separated and we'd like to see them back with their parents, how do we deal with that? And we can't just, throw them across the border kind of a thing. And so it's kind of an ongoing problem at least so far, has no resolution.
Thanks for the call at 800-642-1234. Ray joins us now in Milwaukee. Ray, hi.
Very important subject. I wish they would have brought it up, and I guess Trump would have been the one to bring it up, the Iraq War, and Joe Biden voted for it. Hundreds of thousands of Americans left body parts behind in Iraq and also their lives. Million Iraqis dead. That would have been a great subject, and I wish the commentator would have brought it up. And Trump wants to bring the troops home from Afghanistan, and I don't know why that wasn't part of last night's debate.
Ray, thanks for the call. Tim, would that have been a good issue to hear from the candidates on?
Yeah, it would. And originally, apparently, what was supposed to be the third debate, was supposed to be on foreign policy, but then the moderator decided to go with some different issues. We did get a little bit of national security, foreign policy, but not enough to bring up issues such as the one just mentioned. And yeah, that would have been something that Trump is in other locations has certainly hammered Biden over his vote in that regard.
Thanks for the call, Ray. We're talking to Tim Hagel, associate professor of political science at the University of Iowa, talking about last night's presidential debate, the second of three, but the last of three, sort of. The second one didn't happen. Tim, I don't ever gamble on politics or make predictions publicly, and it's good because if I did, I would have bet and said that last night's debate wasn't going to happen after the second one was canceled. Were you surprised?
A little bit, yeah. It did seem when they were talking early on, especially after the second one was canceled, like you say, that maybe they just weren't going to agree, and so we were only going to get one debate. And, that might have been okay, but like I said, this debate did seem to give us a little bit more information. The candidates, particularly Trump, seemed to be a more settled, more restrained in his approach, disciplined, some of the words that were used to describe it. And, Biden responded in kind for the most part, but we still get him to mix up a little bit. So it ended up being worth it.
Let's take one more caller. Pat is with us, calling from Highway 57. Pat, hi.
Good afternoon, gentlemen. First of all, the other speaker from Iowa, I spent about 3 months, 4 months, working in the state of Iowa in Cedar Rapids for the flood recovery. And you folks have great potential on the corn liquor or ethanol.
Why? Okay, just briefly, Pat, we're running out of time. Your thought on the debate.
Okay. Now, about the debate, everything gets, you know, talked about the energy and that. Okay. He wants, Joe Biden wants to increase the, our need less on coal, more on renewable. Okay. Does he have, are there plans in place? That's something I wish somebody would have talked about.
Pat, thanks for the call. Pat, not seeing a fleshed out plans here. Tim, do we usually get real well-developed plans in a debate format?
Often not. Sometimes if a candidate knows an issue is going to come up, that they'll have it, or they'll have it prepared on their website, like a white paper or something like that, and they're able to hit the high points in a debate kind of a thing. But you know, usually that's the kind of a thing where they're going to have to develop it later once they get into office.
Thanks for calling in our last minute or so, Tim. What are you watching for now? I mean, Election Day is already happening. People are already voting. But what are you watching for between now and that Election Day?
Well, basically, turnout. You know, we're seeing very high turnout, record turnout in terms of early voting, mail-in voting, that kind of a thing. But it may be that just people are shifting their votes, that they would have ordinarily voted in person. This time they're doing it through the early voting. And so we'll have to see if the turnout is actually higher and what that means, because both sides right now are pretty energized. The big question is what those middle voters are, what are they going to do? Are they going to turn out? And if they do, who are they going to vote for?
Tim, thanks a lot for joining us today.
You're very welcome.
Tim Hagel is an associate professor of political science at the University of Iowa. We talked to him about last night's final debate between President Trump and former Vice President Joe Biden. Coming up, misinterpreted COVID-19 data continues to spread across social media channels, making it confusing sometimes to figure out what's true and what's not. We'll talk to a public health educator about wading through the information overload, and you can learn more in a report. You can find it over at wiscontext.org. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. Listening to Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll find out why Wisconsin may see looser limits on some kinds of air pollution. Now, there's a lot of information out there about the pandemic, and there's a lot of misinformation, too, and it can spread quickly. Some of the most popular messages come out of a misinterpretation of real data. A new piece from WisContext traces an infodemic going along with the pandemic. Lindsay Leininger is a public health scientist at the Tuck School of Business at Dartmouth College, where she teaches and writes about data-driven health policy. She co-directs Dear Pandemic, a social media campaign providing credible, comprehensive, and timely info related to COVID-19. She's quoted in that WisContext piece. Lindsay, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Rob. Great
well,
to be here.
That WisContext piece uses that phrase, the term infodemic. What do people mean by that?
Infodemic is a term that's been coined by the World Health Organization and now is spreading rapidly, I think, in the news, that really talks about this information overwhelm that we're all feeling right now with just the glut of information, both accurate and inaccurate, that's spinning about the pandemic.
Let's focus on the inaccurate side. I imagine a Dear Pandemic, you are hearing a lot of misinformation, whether deliberately or not. What kind of things are you hearing these days?
You know, we write a lot about COVID is more serious than the flu. And I think that this is probably the one truth that we struggle the most with in terms of batting down misinformation. But I will note that really our tack at Dear Pandemic is to note that the best defense against misinformation is a strong offense. So we really focus most on pushing out the good stuff and keeping the toxic stuff from circulating.
And I realized I asked that question in a way that was going to lead with the false stuff. And that's part of the message you're sending, it sounds like, to lead with the real information.
And Rob, did you see what I did there? I answered your question with the truth, that COVID is more dangerous than the flu.
And do you think that the media is and policymakers are understanding that message, leading with the truth rather than digging down into the bad stuff first?
I think so, although this is a long-known communication scholar finding, but I do think it's becoming more important to practitioners and more known among practitioners like myself, because what we've seen is just this amplification of the toxic stuff with the sharp rise in social media. So it's becoming really a policy concern in a way that I think is new.
One story that I've heard a lot has to do with how many people die of COVID-19. And people point at a statement from the CDC that talked about a very specific element of how deaths are reported. When we look at that, what do we learn?
I think we learn that lots of different specific information is being used for very specific purposes. But again, I really focus on the fact that COVID is lethal. It has killed more upwards of 200,000 Americans, regardless of what diseases they also happened to die with when they died from COVID. And we need to keep our eye on the prize here, which is keeping safe while we continue to wait for a vaccine and or therapeutics.
One more thing that makes this difficult is, especially early on, there were some mysteries about the disease. Our first reads on them changed as we got better information. The thought that, okay, this is mainly or in large part spread through contact, and we learned, no, we're probably more likely breathing it in. How do we communicate in a changing situation like that?
Rob, I love this question. Thank you so much for it. So one of my biggest messages on Dear Pandemic is that science is a method, not a stable body of facts. So the scientists who are learning the most and the ones you can trust the most are the ones who are willing to say, we have learned something new and the old guidance therefore no longer applies. The scientists you need to worry about are the ones who thought they knew the truth back in March and are not willing to admit the scientific method has led us to new and different places.
Talking to Lindsay Leininger from Dartmouth College, part of the Dear Pandemic team. We're talking about the spread of misinformation related to COVID-19 and how to make sure the good stuff comes out on top. Lindsay, is it easier in our social media landscape for bad information to spread sometimes than the good information?
I think so, because we go to social media to connect, right? It's all about connection and connecting and personal connection. And while you can absolutely trust that your friends have your best interests at heart, you can't trust their scientific expertise much of the time. So it's always good to trust but verify. If you see something on social media shared by a friend, go and verify it by a known expert in the field before you pass it along.
What are some sources you point people toward, apart obviously from Dear Pandemic, to find the good information and maybe to double check that stuff that the random person online is sharing with us?
Well, thank you again for that question. Yeah, so dearpandemic.org is our website, and we actually have curated a list of trustworthy resources that people can go to look for news that we find credible.
Name some names, please. What are a couple that you like?
Sure, yeah. We are big fans of public health departments. We like the data that comes out of state public health departments, including Wisconsin. We like a lot of the data that's coming out by NPR and the New York Times for national trends in the metrics. We also like the reporting done by Stat News, who has graciously made all of their COVID coverage free during the pandemic.
Now, one bias, and I'll confess to this myself, that we might have as news viewers is there's been a lot of bad news, and my brain really wants to see good, happy stuff. And there are some positive developments out there for sure. How do we counteract that bias to look for some good news and make sure it doesn't steer us in the wrong path?
Rob, I so appreciate that because I, too, want to maintain hope. And in fact, we have to. And we have to be hopeful. This pandemic will end. Our society will come through it. And I take a lot of hope into the scientists right now who are making innovations in science and treatments and vaccines at rapid pace. I take a lot of hope in all of the small businesses who have really creatively kept their customers safe And well served during this. So I really look at on the ground innovators as my source of hope. And I got to tell you, it's a wellspring that has kept giving throughout this whole pandemic.
You know, when I think of something like nutrition, Lindsay, it seems like there's so much basic advice that is easy to repeat again. Better to eat more fruits and veggies, less candy and chips. And there's some basic stuff like that with COVID, the masks, the avoiding crowded indoor gatherings, keeping the social distance. How important is it just to keep repeating the stuff that we all, I think, kind of already know?
I think it's important to keep repeating it, but I also think it's important to connect it to an emotion. I do not want to get my loved ones sick. They do not want to get me sick. We wear masks to protect each other. I do not want to infect anybody in my community, and I know they care about me too. So we keep our distance. I think we really need to tie the guidance to emotions because humans respond much more to emotion.
Any last advice for how we can help clean up the information circulating out there in a nice, polite way, given that it might be, you know, our uncle or aunt, for example, sharing it, you know, to communicate the good information without burning bridges with our loved ones?
Yes. So everybody has that uncle who is spewing conspiracy theories. And even though you keep pushing out good information, you do feel compelled to debunk the junk. So lead with kindness, preserve that personal connection. And one effective way that science shows us to do this is to tell what's called a truth sandwich. So start off with a fact, debunk the fallacy, reinforce the fact again. So masks are wonderful. They help us stay safe. You may have heard that they are ineffective. Science shows us that's not wrong. Let's wear a mask to protect you and me both.
We'll leave it there. Lindsay, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you, Rob.
Lindsay Leininger is a public health scientist at the Tuck School of Business at Dartmouth College, where she teaches and writes about data-driven health policy. She co-directs Dear Pandemic, a social media campaign providing credible, comprehensive, and timely info related to COVID-19. She was quoted in a recent WisContext piece on COVID-19 misinformation. Find a link at WPR.org/Central Time. Coming up, we'll check out two environmental stories affecting different parts of Wisconsin. That's up next here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up today at 6, it's 1A+, and their weekly look at the biggest stories overseas takes spotlights to Nigeria, Iran, and Russia, and finds out what connects those last two to voters in Florida. It's time for the Friday News Roundup on 1A+. That's today at 6. Now, new EPA rules will affect how Wisconsin utilities regulate smog, and some hazardous contamination has been found in Sheboygan on a site near Lake Michigan. Danielle Kading is a WPR reporter. She's been following both of those stories. Danny, welcome back to the show.
Hi, Rob. Thanks for having me.
Let's start in Sheboygan, Danny. Tell us this about this Sheboygan Armory site. It sounds like it's a development kind of years in the making here.
Yeah, I mean, this site, which right now is undergoing demolition, is kind of a fixture of the city. The armory was first built in 1941, and it was historically used as a lumber yard. And so that prompted city officials and local officials to kind of look into what was there back in 2015, and there was an environmental assessment of that site that was done. And that assessment actually found evidence of contamination, things like volatile organic compounds and arsenic, things that generally would result from that kind of historic use. And that information was submitted to the city, but the city never submitted that information to the state. And that is something that their environmental consultant advised them to do in order to keep on the up and up with state laws. And so the city only recently reported that contamination to the state after a Sheboygan native tipped off state regulators.
Right. Yeah. Talk a little more about the citizen complaint, in effect, that led to this 2015 report coming out in 2020.
Yeah, sure. Sheboygan native Tara Wirtz, who actually now lives in Waukesha, she started kind of digging into the site because she was looking at trying to save it from demolition because it's a pretty important place to her family and her father in particular. And in the process of doing that, she uncovered this 2015 environmental assessment that showed evidence of contamination at some locations on the site. Now, I should say that this contamination that was found, the consultant said that it's relatively low and it does not appear to be widespread. But they also said that more sampling would likely be required to get a better idea of whether or not the contamination is low as they in fact thought. So she ended up sending this information to regulators and they in turn asked the city to submit that information to the state.
So what's happening on the ground now and what's next?
That is a good question. Now, the DNR has asked the city to investigate contamination at the site. They have 60 days to come up with a plan for investigating contamination there, and they have to also hire an environmental consultant to take a look at it.
Talking to Danielle Kading from WPR News, looking at a couple of environmental stories affecting Wisconsin right now. Moving to another part of the state now, Danny, the Federal Environmental Protection Agency made a change to some air emissions regulations. What is changing?
Yeah, so the EPA proposed a revised rule on Thursday, not this Thursday, but the last one, that basically requires power plants in about a dozen states to cut summer emissions of nitrogen oxides. And I know nobody out there knows what that is probably, but it contributes to ozone pollution. And so this rule revision was made to improve air quality in downwind states or neighboring states. So say, for example, if you've got a lot of pollution coming out of Illinois, then Illinois should be taking steps to reduce the effects of that pollution on their neighboring states like Wisconsin. And in fact, they will be one of the states that has to do that. But under this revision, Wisconsin won't. They had previously been required to curb emissions as part of a previous update of the rule, but they were removed from that list. And essentially the reason behind that was because they have essentially reduced emissions enough that it's not having a significant effect on neighboring states. Any pollution that's stemming or any ozone pollution that's stemming from Wisconsin really isn't having an effect on other states in the Midwest.
Who is affected by a restriction like this? What kind of industry or utilities or things like that would have had to make changes or have made changes under this kind of guideline?
Yeah, so this could have meant that power plants in Wisconsin would have had to take steps to further reduce their emissions from power plants. You know, in the last decade or so, we've seen a lot of them install pollution controls to bring down their emissions. And they could have been asked to do even more under this rule. But they, because of the revision, will no longer have to do that. That doesn't mean that they're not taking steps to reduce their emissions. In fact, a lot of utilities are taking steps right now to shut down coal-fired power plants or examining other sources of energy, although environmental groups say they're not moving fast enough and they'd like them to explore ways to do that a lot quicker.
And with concerns about ozone pollution, whether it's coming from within the state or outside our borders, where does that tend to affect communities around the state?
So the ozone pollution in Wisconsin really is kind of centered around southeastern Wisconsin along the shoreline of Lake Michigan. They've struggled for years to attain federal air quality standards in that area. And the EPA actually reduced the list of areas that would have to meet smog regulations along the Lake Michigan shoreline back in 2018. And that's resulted in a legal challenge from Clean Wisconsin. And this past July, a federal appeals court actually ruled that the EPA has to take another look at that and provide more explanation as to why they decided some areas didn't have to meet those regulations.
And speaking of objections from environmental groups, has anyone objected to Wisconsin being taken off of this list of states needing more pollution controls?
No, it sounds like business and environmental groups are in agreement, at least on the air pollution that crosses state lines, and that, the steps that have been taken so far to maintain compliance with federal standards have resulted in significant reductions in emissions. But they do say that, having states like Illinois, which still have to, cut back on some of the emissions from their power plants, that could potentially help with ozone pollution issues along the Lake Michigan shoreline.
And Danny, before we let you go, you had pointed out to us a press release from the state DNR showing some improvements in Wisconsin's air quality. What kind of things are we seeing there?
Yeah, so this is the latest report from the Wisconsin DNR, and they found that 95% of people in the state live in an area that meets federal air quality standards. And that's based on 15 years of air quality data that's been collected through the last year. And so they're really celebrating that fact. They've seen reductions of other emissions as much as 89% for things like sulfur dioxide, which come from coal-burning power plants. So they say that's all a good thing. The one thing that other folks are pointing out is, yes, this is good that pollutants have declined, but what about carbon dioxide? That's the real thing that contributes to greenhouse gas emissions and issues with climate change, and we need to be looking at ways to reduce carbon dioxide emissions moving forward.
And in just our last couple of minutes, Danny, it's also up there in the atmosphere. We got our first big snows in Wisconsin, and in Superior. How did things look up there?
We were supposed to get anywhere up to 8 inches the other day, and there's no snow outside my window. So it looks like it turned more into like a rain snow mix, at least here in the Twin Ports. And so we dodged a bullet this time, but I guess we'll see what happens with the rest of the fall and winter.
Now, you live in Superior. Do you look forward to a lot of snow any given winter?
Well, full disclosure, Rob, I live in Duluth.
Okay.
but I
work in Superior, I should say, yes.
Yes, I work in Superior, but I do look forward to the snow, although not quite this early.
Danny, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Yeah, thank you, Rob.
That's Danielle Kading, Wisconsin Public Radio reporter based in Superior. She joined us for a look today at a couple of different environment-related stories. A project in Sheboygan that has some evident signs of contamination there. And then on these EPA rule changes when it comes to air quality concerns, ozone-causing chemicals coming from the Environmental Protection Agency. Weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m., it's The Morning Show with Kate Archer-Kent. Monday at 8, isolation can have a big emotional and mental health impact on seniors, and the pandemic is raising the risks. Kate's guest shares the scope of the problem and some possible solutions. That's Monday at 8 on The Morning Show. Hey, coming up, it's going to be Food Friday, and we'll be talking in about a half an hour about great fall recipes. And it's a great time to share some of your favorites. Head over to the Ideas Network Facebook page and tell us what you like to do with your winter squash, your root vegetables, and other fall staples. And we've got some great recipes from our guest at WPR.org/Food Friday. Get ready for a butternut squash soup. Her version sounds really good. I made one, as I'll talk about, last Sunday during the Packer game. It was a highlight of the Packer game for me in many ways. Hopefully this weekend will look a little better. Coming up next, though, news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then we'll take a look at the meaning and significance of Confederate monuments through the battles over whether to preserve or remove statues of a particular Confederate general. We'll talk to the author of the book, Down Along With That Devil's Bones, A Reckoning with Monuments, Memory, and the Legacy of White Supremacy. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time.